Oh, you want to go live first?
Okay, yeah, go for it. What was that? I'm not losing out on premium Jenny content.
I was just saying that I feel like the momentum of the season's been, we knew the momentum of the season was going to be a bit weird because kind of episode one and two should have been the end of last season. But I feel like obviously those two episodes that started the season were like huge, speeding along, big momentum. And then they had two episodes to kind of settle. And then this episode feels like kind of almost stationary in terms of action. Like there's not that much that progresses things here, but there's a huge amount of like characters making decisions or like having conversations. Like I feel like there's, if there was two themes this episode, it's either people telling the truth or like having hard conversations with a lot of like personal insight, or there ain't no rest for the wicked.
Or sometimes
Like
both.
it sometimes, but
I feel like with Kristen Cole.
yes, so Kristen Cole, he's definitely well, he's been suicidal for years again, like years and years and years. But I do enjoy the fact that obviously this was kind of the title of this episode is for him, like the Unbowed and Unbent, because it's
Because of
based
course
on
he is Dawnish and bowed and
he's
bent and
Dornish.
broken, yeah.
So the whole conversation with Dame, not Damon, Dayron.
They're on, yeah.
And what's it called?
Ormond.
Ormond about
Is it
the
Ormond?
Dornish.
Yeah.
Ormond was to set up or to draw in Christian Cole's kind of depressive affirmations.
Also, I found it interesting, and I've only ever it's only the penny's only just dropped. It's unbowed, it's unbowed and
That's you.
unbent,
Yeah.
Not unbroken.
not unbroken. Because Kristen Cole, in particular, but I think can apply to other characters. Kristen Cole's a very broken man.
Oh, very broken.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was broken the day he like episode one, season one, really. Like, yeah,
Yeah. Oh,
right.
interestingly though, and I genuinely can't remember if I've ever mentioned this. I rewatched the beginning of season one. I haven't managed to do a full rewatch yet, but the tourney is where the tourney at the beginning where Rhaenyra visits the new heir. Gawain Hightower is in that melee. Gawain Hightower and Kristen Cole
Oh.
were both there at the tourney. Gawain never takes his helmet off. They clearly hadn't cast,
They
what's
hadn't
he
cast him
called?
at that point, yeah.
They hadn't cast him. So he's wearing his ridiculous goofy helmet with the Hightower on it the whole way through. And it has
Oh.
Alicent like kind of Damon takes him down. Damon like knocks him off his horse and it causes Alicent to get all flinchy. But we never see his face. So it's interesting that obviously those guys, they have a relationship technically longer than Rhaenyra has a relationship with Kristen, because they would have met at the tourney. They would have been in the list together.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just something that I noticed on rewatching, and I was like, oh, yeah, he was there all the way back then.
Yeah.
How about that? I need to do a rewatch for sure.
Yeah.
It's good on rewatch. One thing I think will that I find with Game of Thrones rewatches, because I've done a few of them now, is the it's easy to notice the pacing circumstances in this season. But on rewatch, when there's another season out or whatever, and all of the dust has settled on the newness of this season, I think it matters a lot less. There are other episodes in Game of Thrones that are oddly paced, but that sort of doesn't matter. Like
Yeah.
when you know there's just a next episode, you almost I don't want to say you almost don't think of them by episode by episode. You kind of do, but
I
also,
feel like binging helps with that. I
yeah.
think the ebb and flow of the seasons, when you watch, like I'm very excited when I get on my rewatch to watch the end of season two straight into season three.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to feel like deeply satisfying.
Yeah. I think that's going to be very much the case. It has in previous, because when Game of Thrones hit like its low point, sort of with Was it like after Stannis had died a little bit and
like season 5 going to season 6 and then sharp downhill from there.
Sort of, and then Hardhome brought it back up for a bit, and then you had the Battle of the Bastards, that was all right. So it did it, but it had a dip there. That dip is not as bad on rewatch, in my opinion, because there are things to look forward to, as it were. There are things that it's setting up to do, and I think this is the same with this episode. Actually, is that this episode, whilst not much has explicitly progressed, I think it's going to. I think next. I haven't seen the trailer for this, so I could be completely off the mark. I think next week's episode is going to have a lot of things happening, and I think this is the set them up for the knock them down.
This is a very good setup episode. I feel like a lot was said.
Yeah. So I actually, one of the things I particularly found quite interesting about this is Kristen Cole's segment. And I got to be honest.
I was going to say the actor is killing it, you know. He's really...
Like the misery of warfare and like the all of the like underhanded techniques of war is interesting. And like if you really know the land...
Yeah,
forcing people into like using the typography, it feels very like Vietnam.
Yeah,
like it's classic. You know, the people who know the environment, knowing how to push people who are supposedly superior into positions of danger.
Yeah, I probably need to rewatch this episode because Oscar Tully was about, wasn't he?
He's there at the beginning and then he disappears. So his army somehow managed to like flank round to get to the last bridge, get the army across the bridge, and then burn the bridge while Kristen Cole and Gawain are floundering in the kind of their march through the swamps and like the spiky things attacking the horses. I thought those were like actual like caltrops or something, but they said it was like a naturally growing plant.
It was a trap. I think it was left was by crap. That
okay,
the one, what's the character, the young character that's
Oscar Tully.
Oscar Tully.
Oscar Tully, okay. That's right. Yes.
Of course, once they're off the horses, they're going to leave the road. If they're going to leave the road, they're going to have to, they're going to think they're making a shortcut through the field, but then they're making a shortcut through a swamp. Then you've got an exhausted army. You've had a hard trudge through difficult terrain with leeches and potentially waterborne bacteria, and they're exhausted from the march. And so it's simple techniques, but it's powerful techniques.
I mean, we've not seen techniques like this in Game of Thrones as of yet, have we?
I feel like the sort of thing that they would have talked about in the Song of Ice and Fire books.
Yeah.
I feel like the sort of thing that it's hard to make it, like you have to have really compelling POV characters that you are able to slog along with and see the misery of it.
Yeah.
Which I feel worked better for either Song of Ice and Fire or this story. This story, you've got kind of ground source characters that you can follow. But if you didn't have those ground source characters to follow, then I can see in Game of Thrones, particularly towards the end when they were starting to streamline their character list, you're not good, and also try and amp up the speed. Like I think so much of Game of Thrones towards season 6 onwards was trying to rush to the finish. You don't have time to have a couple of characters slowly march through a bog for you to go, God, war is miserable, isn't it? So I don't know how they would have, like, I can see why they didn't integrate it into Game of Thrones proper, but it's nice to have.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, they make note that how many troops have left? Like, a lot. Like, a third or something?
A huge amount.
Yeah. Well, I would have fucked off at this point. I'd be like, what the hell? No. I'm done.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I need to rewatch the episode before, because in my brain, I thought that the armies were kind of equal. And then by the end of this episode, obviously, some people might have died in the swamps, or there was some things that did damage. But he said there was 200-1 of the kind of Northmen Green Army to their particular conglomerate of the of the Northmen Black Army versus the Green Army as they were, which is a huge difference.
I think that's possibly exaggeration. I think because they mentioned it in a previous episode where it's like 2 or 3 to 1.
I thought last episode they said 20 to 1.
Oh, so 20 to 1.
I don't know. It seems to be changing. 20 to 1.
Yeah, so presumably it's getting worse as it goes, but also that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like that to get to that point, like, mm-hmm. it's interesting because obviously we know that Cole's on a bit of a suicide run.
Mm.
And Gawain's kind of partially aware. I think instinctually and empathetically he knows that Cole's, before this episode, he knows that Cole is kind of on a run to the finish. But obviously his army doesn't know that. And so is this just really, really bad commanding work to get to the point where your army's fleeing? Like, is he just a really bad leader to get to the point where this much of his army is dead or departed?
Well, this is a Stannis moment, isn't it?
Yeah, like he was saying that he's hoping to be remembered for his, you know, his valor and his death on the battlefield, and you know, very kind of Viking Valhalla, and they'll sing songs of my attempt despite all of this misery, and the word will get back to Alicent, which is a very romantic notion, but it's not what's going to happen. What she's going to get back from him is, God, he was an incompetent leader, and he kind of effed everything up.
Her brother and all his men killed her.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
I did love the physical performance of both the soldiers and Gawain and Cole in this, in that they just look so shattered.
It was great. I love watching those scenes, especially when they get to the bridge at the end. It's
just perfect.
It's like, fuck's sake. Fuck. Yeah, no, that's... Actually, I'm just looking over the episode now. There's quite a lot of, like, just standing around in fields.
Yeah.
Did anyone else notice? I don't know the book on this one. With Bela and Adam, are they related? Yeah, they.
Yeah, so he's her uncle.
Yeah, so
half uncle.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that it seems like they're pairing up her and Adam, but in the book is actually her and Alan get together.
Okay, so. Yeah, because I was sensing some chemistry there.
There's some chemistry there that I think, like, it feels like second boyfriend material. Like the first boyfriend, it was very sweet and smiley, and you know, I'll you know, hold your head up if you hold my head up. And this feels a little bit more, you know, the best you is the one who's looked after. It's a bit more. It feels a bit more mature in a way. But I did enjoy the fact that like. Everyone is exhausted in this episode. Yeah. Everyone's so tired. And the fact that he's like, you know, standing up to Rhaemyra and saying, no, she and the dragon need sleep. Like, they need sleep and they need to eat. And Rhaemyra's like, yes, they do. Okay, I agree. And then obviously Daemon's messing with the plans, as is his wont. Or justified in this case, but as is his wont. But I did enjoy the two of them together.
Yeah. Yeah, they got... Yeah, I... To be honest, I like Bela as a character, and I like Adam as a character as well. Like I would have wanted to see more. To be honest, like every time
it's nice to see Bela actually getting some time to be a character. I feel like she's kind of been floating around in the background, and the fact that again, if this episode is people telling the truth, her saying you know she wanted to go to battle, she wanted valor, it's people wanting valor and glory. Mm. Like Kristen wants valor and glory, but he wants to do it by dying. Bela wanted valor and glory in the eyes of Rhaemyra, and is aware of that, and is aware of the you know the guilt of it. Mm. And she's like, they just have a really nice. Just like straightforward conversation, like that. You know, you can only do so much. You're only human. It's a nice you're only human episode.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of that actually. There's a lot of that.
A huge amount of it.
Yeah.
Alan is a good egg.
Yeah, I like Alan. He's not, well, as far as I'm aware, not one of the ones that turns. So that's good. But, well, I mean, he's more invested in the black side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he has someone that wants to legitimize him.
Yeah.
Basically make him their heirs.
Yeah.
The Dragon Seeds don't really have that.
Hmm.
Whenever there's a character who's not part of the actual, like, central royal line,
mm-hmm.
who is decent and nice, it's so lovely to have.
Mm.
Because of the... Otherwise, you know that so many of these characters are going to die tragically. By instinct, even without spoiling, you know by instinct so many of these characters are going to die tragically. So it's nice whenever kind of a side character that might be able to sidestep the Game of Thrones is decent and nice. It just gives hope for the entire world. Like, the world can't be this bad if people like this exist. And it is nice with, again, between Orwyle and between Alan and Adam. I don't know how many of them are going to survive, but when you have good, decent characters who are basically nice, it's lovely.
Well, I mean, we know that Orwyle survives. So, you know, he's all right. And, of course, he helps.
I mean, again... Because of the changes from the books, some of them might not. We don't know. They could change it.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, actually, so this is a departure from the books. But I don't know if I've said this before. Sunfire is alive. Totally. I thought he would come alive this episode. To be honest, he's coming back alive. Putting that, I'm nailing that to the post, because there is a little theme around these episodes of, or particularly with Aegon as well. Of, like, false death. And everyone thinks Aegon is dead. And
everyone thinks Aemond is missing. Everyone
thought that Tyland was dead.
Tyland as well,
I just put Tyland! Exclamation mark.
Yeah. I was not expecting that one.
I knew they threw him off the boat for a reason.
Yeah.
Well,
I will say, for regarding Sunfire, and in the same, exactly the same breath as Tyland, the classic media format of, you, if it's not on screen, they're not confirmed. And the fact that we've had Sunfire on screen, but, like, there is potential, we don't know how dragons work anatomically. He could be some sort of Cobra-y thing. He could, like, he had flies around him, but, like,
he could be hibernating.
Mm-hmm. He could be hibernating. You know, we've got dragons from stone in the past. We don't know how they, like, and, like, we don't have a dragon keeper, for example, saying, "Ah, look, I have checked its pulse. Time of death is this." Like, unless I have an effectively educated individual going, "Yes, it's definitely dead. I don't trust that he's dead." But
well,
and the fact that the only person who's really done that is Aeon, who said he's alive.
And one other character. Right, Cast Your Mind Back, season 2. Kristen Cole says that Sunfire was slow in the dying.
Died slow, yeah.
Yep. So
that could be slipping into a coma or something. Like, I'm so annoyed that I've spoiled myself, but I am aware that Sunfire has a particularly significant action to take
at
some point in the future that I feel like has got enough.
Well.
Precedent that I feel like they ought to be around for it.
There is this theory.
They even mentioned, Joffrey even has a line about it in Game of Thrones, I'm pretty sure. He tells the story. I don't think he mentions Sunfire by name, but he says what happens with Sunfire in the
end. Yeah. He's telling Margaery.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that scene. Yeah. So Game of Thrones spoiler. Yeah, it doesn't mention Sunfire by name, but it's Aegon's dragon, right?
I think he said Aegon's dragon. Yeah.
Now, I heard a theory, but this could be completely bullshit. That it's a theirs is the theory, not ours. I didn't come up with this one. That Sunfire was originally planned to be killed off as one of the deviations from the books, but after season 2 wrapped, George R.R. Martin, quite famously, he said that he didn't like some of the changes that had gone on. And it might have been the case that he met with showrunners behind the scenes and implored them to veer back towards the source material a little bit more rigidly.
I'm getting those vibes from, you know, from episode three onward. It seems like it's steering back in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I don't...
I mean, I've always been impressed by how well they've weaved the changes in. And, like, I feel like they left enough flexibility for that to happen. And I feel like it's very possible that we're going to get some Sunfire.
In terms of broader changes, there could be some unreliable narration at work as well. You could use that as a hand-waving utility. But it also, there are a few cases. For example, someone pointed out that Rayna is becoming more Nettles-like. So that, I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact that, you know, it might be that whilst they can't do a complete U-turn on that, that they're going to, you know, veer as close as they can back to maybe, it could be because Kristen Cole set up, he said Sunfire was slow in the dying. So it might have been that it was, Sunfire was designed to come back all along, but...
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably the equivalent of, you know, when there's many, I can think of a good number of dramatical series over the years I've watched. I'm thinking of one specific episode of Casualty from like the 90s where there's a rock climber who falls and hits their head and is knocked unconscious and is covered in maggots, and people just assume that they're dead. And then one of the first aiders comes along and is like, no, one sec, they're fine. Look, they've got, you know, a severe concussion, and the maggots actually helped, keep this person from getting an infection. The concept that a mystical creature where no one knows their details of their anatomy could be comatose, hibernating, and, you know, wounded, deep, grievously wounded, because there's flies around Sunfire, but not necessarily 100% dead, is very possible, because we don't know.
Yeah. The other dragon, Rhaenys' dragon, Maelys, looks a lot worse.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, yeah.
Decapitated. Yes. I'd say that's pretty dead.
That's a bit more than a headache, isn't it? That'll usually do it.
I've seen Menafin's not going to help with that.
Yeah. So...
to use the American version.
So, yeah. That's not a hot take. Is that, like, expected and established?
I would be shocked if there wasn't an additional step to Sunfire.
Yeah, I feel like they spent too much time talking about it not to have a payoff.
Oh, yeah, that's also... Yeah, Chekhov's... reviving dragon.
What Chekhov's things do we have in process at the moment? We have Ormond and his Smell-O-Vision. We have Chekhov's Chekhov's Sunfire, and we had the tunnels did come back. Although we're not really sure what's going to happen with the tunnels, because that was a weird cliffhanger for Helena and Elephant in the dark in the tunnels. Like, what an odd thing for them to do. Like, are they going to be rescued by Dreamfire? Is that what's going to happen? Is they're going to somehow end up in the dragon pit and Dreamfire's going to, you know, are we going to finally have Helena and Dreamfire in the catacombs of the Red Keep?
The cats are going to rescue them. The cats will...
Yeah. I did love seeing all the cats. Yeah. Like, have... all caps, cats! Exclamation mark in my notes.
Sir Pounce's great 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 grandparents.
Yeah, yeah. And there was another. There was like a mean cat that.
The Orwells sidestepped.
No, Arya had a specific vendetta against when she was told to catch cats. Yeah. There was one. There was one like ultimate, like. Bastard cat that she would try and catch, she would scratch her up, that she was determined to capture that cat. So the cats, it's one of the nice things when you visually progress from House of the Dragon to Game of Thrones. You can see in the same way as the reversal of the throne going from this much larger, more deadly thing into the Game of Thrones chair as we know it. It's nice to go from a castle with no cats to a castle full of cats and then being like, oh, that's how we got here, okay. This, you know what, cats is the prequel information I need in my life. I don't need to know how Han Solo got his name. I need to know why there's cats.
Oh god, don't remind me.
Oh, that is just yeah.
You know, I mean, like, this is useful information for me. I don't need to know why Han Solo has his name. I need to know why there's cats in the keep.
Does this allude to the possibility that the chair, the throne itself, might be whittled down to a more modest size?
I think that's going to potentially happen. Well, what I would be interested to see is, I don't think the chair is necessarily going to change this series. I don't know if it's going to happen in House of the Dragon, but I think we're definitely going to see an interstitial chair at some point towards the later seasons of Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
I think this chair is going to stay the same, and then at some point, because obviously Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, is it three novellas that exist?
Three novellas.
So far, I think
all of those ones are out of King's Landing. They're like,
I think the second one's in the Riverlands, and then the third one is in the North or the Eyrie or something.
Yeah,
they talk about going to Dorne in between one and two, but it's not like the main story.
So presumably, as the series progresses and Egg matures and things happen in his life, eventually they'll make it back to King's Landing, and I think there'll probably be some phase in between. And I'll be interested to see that. Maybe the chairs they'll start to remove some of these swords as part of this arc. I can see potentially if Aegon comes back to the throne. Helena in season 2 on my rewatch says that Aegon will come back, but he'll have a wooden throne or something. Now we've obviously seen that Aegon can walk and move and all of that sort of thing, and he's not like in a wheelchair. When I think of a wooden throne, I think of a wheelchair. But it might be that he really struggles to get up onto the throne, so maybe they might need to, like, I don't know, put in access routes for him.
Wheelchair ramp,
something. Wheelchair ramp. So they might have to clear some of the swords for Aegon for his accessibility. Something like that. I can see them doing something like that potentially towards the end of the season, if that's what happens with Aegon's.
He could get further injured and lose the use of his legs.
Yeah, I mean, he's having a crappy time of it, but he's showing good progression. But yeah, I can see potentially that being a stepping stone towards Game of Thrones as we know it in terms of the chair. But I do like the cats. Give me the cat stuff.
I can't work out whether or not the difference in chair is like literal or stylistic.
As in, you don't think it will.
As in, they've just made the chair bigger because that's how they've interpreted the chair from the books anyway.
So are you saying that there doesn't, you don't need there to be a canon explanation for why the chair?
It might. I'm questioning whether or not there isn't a canonical explanation. It might just be, this is how we've decided to depict the chair.
I think
it's an opportunity to kind of correct the limitations of Game of Thrones.
And to make it a
canonical reason.
The chair itself, from the books as I understand it, was much bigger than even that. Like, it was ridiculous. But
monstrous.
But the thing is, that's books, isn't it? Like, books, books are a little bit more dreamy, aren't they? And you've always got...
George Martin isn't the best with numbers either. I think he said 1,000 swords, and he didn't realize how big how many... Swords 1,000 actually was. Was it 1,000? I'm pretty sure it was 1,000.
Yeah, it's meant to be 1,000 swords.
But then The illustrations I've seen depict a huge towering thing, like a crazy thing that would just be ridiculous in reality. But in a book, yeah, like, you know, you can sort of make these things work because it's imaginative, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like I like the idea when Damon came and threw the crab feeder's axe on the floor and said, add it to the chair. The idea that theoretically, like, swords could be switched out or weapons be switched out over the years. Like the idea, like if one of the swords like crumbled into, you know, rust, mm-hmm. you could potentially then another conqueror's blade gets inserted. Like it gives a kind of thematic opportunity for things to kind of adjust as the years go on, not only from just reducing inside, which is theoretically the progression, but also allowing for it to kind of fluctuate in size. Mm-hmm. So it might have been this monstrously tall thing, and then, you know, I don't know if there's been other sick or ailing kings in the before Viserys where they decided to kind of spread it out along, like, to make it kind of a lower set of stairs, that sort of thing. Maybe, who knows?
None of them had as good a story as Bran.
Woof.
Okay, I bet I can guess one of Jenny's notes, though.
Oh, okay.
A Feast for Traitors looks a lot like The Last Supper.
Oh, you know what? I don't have that.
Oh,
note.
You don't have that? Oh, no.
I don't have that. No, I have a slightly more obscure literary note for much earlier in the episode. But yes, you're right that, I mean, I think my brain drew a parallel to The Last Supper with Viserys, which is also supposedly a visual reference to The Last Supper. Mm. So my brain was thinking more internally canonical. But yes, I can see that. I can see that.
I don't. The thing is, paintings like that are always like it's not unique to The Last Supper.
Then people sat down to dinner. There's thousands of pictures of that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you got to do a display. You've done A Feast for Traitors. You know, you've written that in Blood on the Wall. It would break the aesthetics of the piece to have people sitting all around the table. You got to, you know, it's a diorama kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a singular angle.
Yeah, exactly. And especially because you can see that it's against a flat wall. So they're expecting Damon to come from that specific angle.
Yeah.
Although
to rewatch the episode for more details. Was this a high tower plot to kill all the gold cloaks? Is it?
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to follow the links, and I was very sleepy when I watched the episode.
The guy, the assassin that we see, the one that talks to the urchin girl, where I'm just trying to find it now.
They then send the pigeon, and the pigeon kind of flies off.
That's the scene.
And then we see Ormond retrieve a pigeon, which is interesting that they use a pigeon, because obviously Game of Thrones canonically everywhere uses ravens, and so you have this sort of network of ravens that's known. But if the Hightowers were using a pigeon system rather than a raven system, then they have an entire set of secret communications that no one else is keeping an eye out for. Like, no one else is looking at, like, people will shoot down ravens assuming that they are communication ravens. But they're not going to shoot down pigeons, assuming, because in this world, the primary means of, like, fast communication is ravens. So if the Hightowers have trained pigeons for their communications, you have a way that the Hightowers were communicating between King's Landing and Hightowers this whole time without it being tracked by the Maesters necessarily.
Yeah.
So that's why Orwyn didn't have notification of what communications were going back and forth to the Hightowers, because he looks after the ravens, doesn't look after pigeons.
Clever. Okay.
So if they were using pigeons this whole time, they've got a completely secret, separate, hidden network of means of fast communication without anyone thinking to shoot down pigeons. Like, canonically throughout Game of Thrones, they've been shooting down ravens all the heckin' time to be like, we've got to interrupt the communication, we've got to stop them from, like, sending signals to all these places. If they were using pigeons this whole time, And they've got an entirely, like, a completely hidden communication network.
Yeah.
Just FYI. I thought of it and I was like, that's nuts. That's so that's crazy. And if that is the case, that this is their, you know, secret way of communication, potentially that's something that's completely died out by Game of Thrones, because there's I can't think of a single reference ever in Game of Thrones proper to pigeon communication. So it might just be this particular generation of old towers, of high towers, using that as their super secret, doubly secret means of communication. Because that must take so much out. Like, if the default is to train ravens, to train pigeons and to do that, that's a lot of work for a secret network that you've got to keep completely undercover. But yeah,
well, as far as I understand
one shot of a pigeon, but it was like a full followed, like, digital shot of this pigeon flying over King's Landing. Like,
whereabouts was it? Was it early on or there it is? Oh, it's about 23 minutes in.
About 23 minutes.
Now, that I don't know if you've recognized the guy. He was one of the Hightower guards at the beginning of this season.
Oh, okay.
You can tell because his eyes are different colors.
Oh, he's got heterochromia.
Nice. Heterochromia, that's the word, yeah.
Did I tell you I interviewed someone with heterochromia a couple of months ago? We offered him the job and he couldn't attend. He had to move away for family reasons. But I was so close to hiring someone with heterochromia, and I was going to ask about, like, has he had weird looks his entire life? neither of the other. So this was a 3-manager interview for a new member of staff. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I was like, oh my gosh, it was so neat to meet someone with heterochromia. And both my manager and the lady from HR were like, what? Like, you didn't see, he had different colored eyes.
Was it like one fully green, one fully blue, or
it was one brown, one blue?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was pretty telling. Like, it wasn't it wasn't like green blue, like you could kind of, it was full heterochromia. But yeah, it was neat. I was sad that he couldn't take the, he was also a really good candidate. But he had to go to Exeter instead, annoyingly. As in Exeter the city, not Exeter the college.
Is there a college in Oxford called Exeter?
Yes.
There's
Exeter College in Oxford.
But
he had to go up to family in Exeter proper.
Mm-hmm. Do you know 15% of Siberian Huskies have heterochromia?
I love it. I love Huskies with heterochromia. It's so beautiful. It's like, honestly, it's so cute. I wonder what genetically that's triggered. Do you think it's because I know, like, Arctic foxes have, like, the very dark kind of features around their eyes, like they're wearing eyeliner, and that's to help prevent snow blindness and reflections off snow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if Huskies getting heterochromia is kind of to have one eye that can see better in the dark and one eye that can see better during daylight.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. That's a good theory.
Maybe something. I feel like there's got to be some evolutionary reason for that to be such a highly favored genetic trait.
Mm. It's so cute. Because it looks cute.
Jenny, just before we go on, your audio is slowly, like, ducking and going high again.
Okay, let me just unplug the mic. I'll pop back in again. You guys,
I think it was a bit like that towards the end of yesterday's stream, so I don't know if there's like an auto leveling thing or something. Well, give the unplugging a go and see what.
I'll try resetting. Carry on talking amongst yourselves. I'm so sorry.
Have you seen those cats where they've got one color on one half of their face and another color on the other half of their face?
Yeah, like the calico.
That's it. Right? Yeah,
they're cute. They're like, I think 99.5% of them are female. It's very rare to have a male calico.
That's amazing. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, nice. Right. Yeah. So I'm just trying not to talk about Game of Thrones before Jenny gets back. There we go.
Welcome back.
Is it better?
We'll probably know in a few minutes, but let's assume so.
Okay, I'll try and settle a bit closer to the microphone as well, because I think a couple of weeks ago someone said I was ducking in and out, and I think that was just because I was, sitting around my seat like a ADHD 7-year-old, and I was just moving to drop the microphone. So I'll try and sit still close to the microphone. A professional podcaster.
Or just like, but make sure, I mean, be comfortable, of course.
Well, we'll see how we go.
Okay, cool. All right. So this is an Ormond. This is an Ormond plan, isn't it? The pigeon, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah. So I feel like I assume his overall mission. And again, I've seen this in the trailer, so it's not necessarily entirely my thought process. But his whole thing is to make Rhaemyra look like a bad queen and kind of destabilize her from the bottom up. So obviously taking the gold is a huge factor in that. If you can't feed your army, if you can't feed your populace, but also like getting rid of her guards, and you know, knowing how close Daemon is with the gold cloaks, that's a two birds one, well, several guards, many guts system, that you're both destabilizing the security of King's Landing, you're meaning that she doesn't have her own private army, you're creating fear, you're, you know, all of that jazz, but also you're gonna upset Daemon, and if Daemon's upset, then she's losing her most valued kind of, or one of her most valued allies. And on top of that, obviously, what I found really compelling, particularly about this episode, is Daemon was predominantly sensible.
Yes.
This whole episode, he was the voice of reason, which is it's kind of terrifying. That he was the one who was telling Rhaemyra what she actually needed to hear, which, you know, it's gossip is gossip. You need to look away.
Mm.
Like, you are queen. If you laugh at it, if you say it's nothing, then people will listen. You have to be true to yourself first. Like, there was so much like really good advice he gave this episode. And obviously the way it ended this episode, with him finding his friends, his guys that he managed to get on his side, his you know, his loyal people who've been around this whole time, who he managed to convince with just a speech that he is, you know, their go-to guy.
His speech was even more convincing than Crispin Cole's was this episode.
Like, and his speech as well is interesting, because, like, in a similar way to Aegon kind of finding the joy and the love of his people when he got crowned, Daemon finding love among these cutthroat, brutish, you know, corrupted police force, like, that was his kind of safety net, his pride, his boys. And so the fallout from that's going to be pretty nasty. So it was a good way of putting him on his back foot. You know, I was, as I said last episode, I was a bit disappointed with Ormond being kind of a mad zealot rather than being a tactical thinker, particularly given his education in Hightower. This episode has brought it back a little bit more. Obviously, he's still a, you know, complete and utter crazy zealot who's aggressive and abusive and raving misogynist. But you know what? He is actually doing some smart plays here. And I'm like, okay, hats off to you. Like, you're giving me the plot I wanted, which was highly educated people versus people who are based on instinct and emotion. And he is very emotional, but he's playing against Rhaemyra's emotions, which is, I wanted that.
Yeah, well, see, Ormond seems to have this internal struggle between the person he is and the person he wants to be. Like when he's playing pseudo chess with Daeron, and his instinct is to just like toss the board and be like, fuck you. And then he sort of calms himself down and says, it's like, never apologize for victory.
In some ways, that's so much more unsettling.
Like,
if you don't know what he's going to do, you don't know if he's going to like stab the table or stab you, or if he's going to, you know, give you a shoulder massage and say, good job. Like, that's scary.
I feel bad for Daeron. He seems like a good kid, you know, all things considered in his situation. He's just, you know, he's being, you know, Ormond is using him basically to rule, like, in his place.
Yeah.
Is his motivation.
And he even...
Interesting. Sorry, you go, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, he even made the little currency, which is a highly illegal. You can't...
I thought that was playing a little bit close to the chest. The idea of going straight for, like, this is my new king, I'm minting currency.
Yes.
Like, that's...
Like, presumably, now, okay, this is another weird Jenny shout out in the same way as the pigeons. Mm-hmm. Presumably, the gold that is being reminted in Daeron's face comes mm-hmm. from somewhere. Is oh, this yeah. Rhaenyra's gold that is being reminted?
I'm pretty sure that there's a substantial amount of the gold in Old Town, but.
Oh, in Old Town, yeah. But yeah, isn't that just a genius way though of making the currency kind of irrelevant? Is if she wants the gold back, the only gold that she can have without paying a lot of dividends to have it re-smelted is to either use the face of Daeron as her currency mm-hmm. or to not have the gold. Like, that's a really good play. I'm mm-hmm. impressed. But if that's the plan, is that the only gold that's available to you, Rhaenyra, you have to fight a war and you've got no gold. The only gold that you can have is ones with your half-brother's face on it.
Well, yeah.
Like, that's a kick in the teeth.
Yeah, although these are gold dragons, right? And the only people spending gold dragons are aristocrats, right?
Potentially, like it could be a year's worth of wage for, say, a soldier or a foot soldier, that sort of thing.
Okay, and a bourgeois merchant or something then.
Like. Merchants. And but that's still, you know, even if it's like political branding wise, if you're paying your liege lords in coins that have another heir to the throne on it, like... Mm-hmm. It's a good play.
You smelt it down, wouldn't you? You'd have to smelt it down.
Yeah, you'd smelt it down. But even then, you'd then have to break it off into what, chips?
Bars, like, depends what you're buying. I mean, it's like stealing someone's swimming yeah. certificate, isn't it? It's just like, that's pathetic. It's just like...
I found that interesting. I also like the fact that during that sequence with the chess game... Mm-hmm. We had already had the conversation with Gawain talking about how he would let Ormond win when they were racing up the tower.
Yeah.
Because he was a thin-skinned twat or something.
Yeah, yes.
Even back then, he was a thin-skinned twat. And Daeron doesn't let him win. He apologizes and he says, you know, it was a close thing. I didn't, you know, all of that jazz.
It was an accident.
I think that. It was an accident. But, like, it's interesting that A, Ormond nearly had his full hissy fit, and B, kind of gives Daeron some respect for beating him, while obviously gives no respect to Gawain for letting him win. Mm. It's also interesting that both... So last episode we had Ormond, you know, calling Gawain a cunt, and then we had this episode with Gawain calling Ormond a twat. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, deeply ingrained misogyny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea, again, Ormond mm-hmm. washing his hands, like the whole bathing theme that's going through.
He's always there washing his hands. Every scene there is a reference to his... aversion to smells, germophobia, whatever, you know, this sort of...
And the Hightower kind of... It's very interesting with the Hightower proliferation of bathing and washing. So we have him washing his hands and him bathing. We had Alicent bathing and, you know, sinking into the tub and all of those sort of things. And then we have Gawain during all of the situation kind of learning from foot soldiers and being filthy this episode, like full on... bad hair day, mud splatter, the full works. Like, they weren't afraid to make him look absolutely
soggy boy.
Yeah. And like, if Gawain turned up right now in front of Ormond having got bog swamp on him, like, Gawain might just not make it out of the room.
Yeah. I just saw another note just scanning the episode. Alan is also just admitting to Rhaenyra towards the end of the episode that the Valyrian house is a bit strapped for cash too, which makes sense because
the Corlys's tower castle will burn down. And the fleet is, you know, decimated after the gullet.
Yeah. So they're pretty, they've probably also paid a shitload of debts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, I think they've contributed what they could.
And yeah, so and also in that same scene, Ormond has declared Daeron king, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it's the assumption that genuinely Aegon has defected or, you know, stepped down, and Aemond is not available, is dead.
One king like, is as good as another.
Yeah, but to jump to the third heir, when they've got the king, the heir, and we also have, you know, to jump to the... I have hiccups, I'm so sorry. to jump to the third heir is a bit preemptive.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he's about to be bumped down to fourth, anyway.
Bumped down to fourth? Who comes in?
Well, Helena, Helena's baby.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Does that put him down to fourth? Why...
It would. I mean, a male first primogeniture, you know, he would...
Oh, yeah!
Next in line after again.
Aegon, Maegar, presuming Maegar's happening, then...
Mindor.
Then Aegon, then Daeron.
Right, yeah. Are we assuming that this is... who's the father of Helena's? Is it Aegon?
Well, that's... Well, the timeline's a little bit shaky in the show. You know, is it Aemond, is it Aegon? I don't think they've really...
I haven't specified.
No, either way,
my betting is on Aemond. It just makes sense to me in terms of the timeline and in terms of like the being burnt by Vhagar timeline. I don't think that Aegon was able to do it. I think it was.
Oh well, the thing is,
he said he has a line about his cock being. Something
about his cock. Pop burst like a sausage.
Exactly. But that's why I'm with the other brother.
Well, yeah, but that would only have been about 2 weeks prior to this episode.
I mean, the timeline's a bit squiffy because, like, we don't know how many days or weeks have passed since Rhaenyra has taken the crown. Like, obviously, it's been long enough for her to investigate and hire Manderly. It's been long enough for her to fill the entire Red Keep with cats. It's been long enough for Daemon to go back and forth to the Eyrie on Dragonback. It's been long enough. Like, we don't know how long that was, and we don't know how long it was potentially between. Like, it feels. I'd be interested to rewatch it and see whether or not we can work out how long the timeline's been.
And well, how far along Helena is? Is she a month along? I mean,
and how? Well, she's starting to show, so I'd say she's probably 3 to 4 months in, like starting to show properly. And like the thing that I am using for my timeline is Aegon's injuries are pretty well healed. Like I used this example last week. I got a burn scar on my arm from a hot water bottle last September. I still have a purple mark on my arm. Now it's pretty well healed, but I still have a purple mark on my arm that is visible. A year later, Aegon went from being melted by Vhagar to being basically walking, talking, moving, you know, he's still in some discomfort, but that's, you know, the skin that's fused. He's going to be
over his milk and a poppy addiction.
Yeah,
or...
he doesn't have any discoloration. Now, obviously, he's had some very good maester care, but the fact that he went from being melted to being functional.
Yeah.
I would say it's been a good number of months since he had his incident with Vhagar.
To be honest,
I'd say at least 3 months. I mean, minimum.
I'd say at least 3 months.
I mean, I'd say a year and 2 years. And I think this is where it starts getting a bit like, is this Targaryen magic? Is he healing faster from fire because he's, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. Again, it'd be kind of nice to rewatch the episode because a lot of these episodes feel like they're kind of a day in the life, but I think a lot of them are a week or a month. And things like the progression of armies from I kind of need to look up a map and see like the episode. This episode obviously had them traveling from like named rivers to other parts of named rivers as an army predominantly foot. That could be months for all we know. Like it seems to be like a day or two how it's presented in the show. But for all we could know, that could be showing months or weeks passing. So that, yeah, I find the timeline, it's not as blatantly squiffy as it was in Game of Thrones, the later seasons, where timelines were just balked. But I feel like a lot more time has passed than we think between the death of Viserys and now.
Yeah, that's a tough. Yeah, that's pretty convincing, to be honest, because I'm just looking at the map now. Do they say where they go? I see the Stony Sept, and yeah, they're fucked by losing those bridges. Do they go around Hollow Hill? Is that something they say?
I feel like I remember the term Hollow Hill, but that could be big brain.
Yeah, that's if they go round that way, that's yeah. Cause they're trying to get to Tumbleton, Gold Road, Hayford Castle, Blackwater Rush. Damn, they could really. And then they've come from where's the twins? Oh, the twins are miles north. So they've come a long way. Yeah, that's. I mean, yeah, the Northmen. I mean, where would they have come from? Would they have come from Greywater Watch, Moat Cailin, White Harbor, Winterfell?
They had a line about them coming past the Twins, because yeah. Or was it the Twins, or was it Rhythron? Because of the lady joining the council,
they would have come. They would have come by Riverrun, yeah.
Riverrun. So yeah. Was that the lady who joined the council? Was she a Tully?
She was the Frey woman. She was the Frey woman.
We know that at least the Northern army has at least crossed the Twins by the point of the beginning of the episode.
Because...
Which we already knew, because we'd already had the Greybeard turn up. But that, again, gives a little bit clearer idea of where in the Riverlands they were, but obviously we don't know where they progressed from there.
They're heading south. The woman, the Frey, was I looked up her name earlier today because I I don't even know if they mention her name, but can I see it in IMDb?
It would have definitely been mentioned in the earlier episode where it had Jace negotiating.
Yeah.
Again, and the Harrenhal pass the parcel, continuous pass the parcel regarding Harrenhal.
Well, yeah, she wanted Harrenhal. That was part of their deal that they made with Jace.
Mm-hmm. She's angry because Rhaemyra's it's so funny to me that there must be other castles other than Harrenhal available. That if you're going to flippantly promise Harrenhal to the
Sabatha Frey,
to the Freys, or to any old person who happens to kill Aemond, or any old person like who just happens to be a lord, surely there's other castles that are going to be conquered in the meantime that you could promise to your dragon riders. I'm sure. There must be holdings, there must be lands, there must be, you know, stewardships that by nature of conquest you can offer to your essential soldiers.
I think Harrenhal is, it's not necessarily the castle, I think it's the status. Owning Harrenhal makes you a major lord, I think, in this realm. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Freys, you know, they have a bridge, which is not nothing. Like, it's a, you know, but it's not.
Nice bridge.
It's a nice bridge and an important bridge. You know, they got the Straits of Hormuz. It's just like they want, you know, they want the status of that, you know, a place where, you know, some of the biggest tourneys in the realm have taken place, where. Thingy the Conciliator, Jaharis the Conciliator, handed over. You know, like that. I'm not saying it's like the Birmingham of Westeros, right? Like it's a big central location where a lot of important stuff happens.
Like the Bristol.
I mean, yeah, we could go Bristol if you want.
similar vibes.
Yeah, yeah. But it's So I think, because like the thing is, no one in their right mind would seriously want Harrenhal. It's incredibly expensive to maintain. It's barely functional. It's cursed. Yeah. There's not much you can
cool
really.
Witches in it.
Yeah. Well, she'll chase you out. I think maybe. You know, you got to share it with a witch. That's always, yeah, its own type of complications there.
Always happy to.
I mean, it doesn't even come with a maester, you know, like it's, you got a witch instead of a maester, I guess. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it could be, I mean, it could be worse, but yeah, like it's basically like even Simon Strong was talking about, oh, you know, we got to sort this out. I mean, Damon spent a shit ton of money trying to fix it up a little bit, and even now it looks like shit.
I really think they should like sell it to multiple lords and let them have like some sort of condominium type situation, being like, okay, it is now Harrenhal is owned by the three dragon. You guys can choose your own tower and fix it up as you see fit. It's big enough for the three of you, and they just share. It's now the communal land of the three dragon riders. Maybe that's the way to resolve the curse of Harrenhal, to have it split between three families, and it's big enough for three people with their dragons, and they can then spend their own money to do up each tower as they see fit. Maybe that's the solution.
And then they can have a sitcom.
Yeah. Three dragon riders in Harrenhal. Do 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 do.
But speaking of Sabbath of Frey, she of course joins the small council in this episode.
I loved how bitchy the beginning of that. It was so bitchy and so gossipy. And it was like, it would have been great in a way to have all of that kind of whispered bitchy exposition for the beginning of a season.
Yeah.
I feel like having Tabitha come in and her and Manderly having that exact same conversation where I'm being like, oh yeah, that's the whore and that's Corlys's bastard. And that, like, just like her coming in and being like, what is with this council where we have like openly named bastard as Hand of the King? We have a whore who is Daemon's lover as the mistress of whisperers. We have Damon, the rogue prince. We have Rhaemira, the cruel or whatever. Like, can you imagine coming in as the new kid in school and being like, what have I walked into?
Yeah. They're quite, I think the twins and White Harbor are quite close together. So they might actually.
They probably potentially know each other.
Yeah, if not by having been to similar events or each other's weddings.
Like similar status. Yeah. I do enjoy the fact that we have now, I'm trying to remember whether or not, obviously Cersei was on the council by nature of her being the queen mother and kind of the acting regent, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Margaery ever went into the small council. I'm trying to remember whether or not Olenna Tyrell ever was technically on the council. She just kind of stepped into the room because she could, because she was Olenna Tyrell and she's a badass. Is this the first time we've seen three women actually named to the council?
I don't know what Sabbatha would necessarily be mistress of. Mistress of Laws, maybe?
Maybe mistress of... Yeah, I don't know. But it's just interesting for her to be named to a position on the council when we have, like, it's one of those heartbreaking and kind of genius things where the cat stayed. Like, at this point in history, we brought cats to the Red Keep and the cats are still there in the times of Game of Thrones. At this time in history, we brought women onto the small council, and there is no women on the small council come Game of Thrones.
No.
So it's the signs of things yet to come kind of foreshadowing, like all of this seeming progression is going to be undercut.
Yeah. Right. Robert was very ladsy, wasn't he? He was.
Oh yeah. He was bro, bro, bro.
Mm.
He had two bros to actually be there.
Although to be fair, he probably didn't even know. Like it's just.
He didn't want to be king.
No, he did not. But yeah, no, See, this is why they've course corrected since since earlier seasons, they've actually got that little bit of levity of, you know, not quite comedy, not, but like, but it's not the the bludgeoning of horrors that we saw through some stretches of Game of Thrones, but also like the earlier part. Yeah,
I do like the fact that you can have a moment where you can just have pure gossipy bitches.
Yeah.
Like, just, I don't feel like having a kind of throwaway conversation over a conversation.
Mm.
I feel like Game of Thrones had a level of self-importance where mm-hmm. every line had to be listened to. If Tyrion was speaking, yeah. he had to be listened to. If Tywin was speaking, he had to be listened to. And that, from a story and directorial standpoint, they stood by that. Like, if this character is having a moment, they're having a moment. Well, I feel like having a overlaid conversation, mm. something that I maybe you would see in Night of the Seven Kingdoms or in House of the Dragon, but I can't think of a single time where you'd have, you know, you'd have a camera highlighting on, say, a crowd scene. It would have two people having a conversation. But having an overlaid conversation, having those two guys discussing, you know, keeping things updated while Rhaenyra is talking over another people, while someone else is talking over it, is something that I feel is so fresh to this series. Mm. And it's nice because it feels quite natural. I feel like this has a kind of a more humanist way of directing. And it's more naturalistic for a show which has a lot more magic. There's a lot more kind of natural conversation happening, and I do like that.
Yeah. Also, we do see in this council meeting, the balls have gone. Oh, metaphorically.
The balls have gone.
What a metaphor there.
I think she was tossing it out last episode, wasn't she? She was saying it's a relic of an old time.
Yeah, yeah. She and now the table is
committed.
Is, yeah, like it's... Which is kind of odd. It's a bit of an odd tradition anyway. Like, it seemed to be only ceremonial, no purpose for it, which might be, you know, why she did it.
Exactly. I think it's interesting to have her trying to be so practical and active in comparison to Viserys, who was not practical and not active. She's putting her heart and soul into it, and whether or not that results in ridiculous burnout, we shall see, literally and metaphorically.
Viserys wasn't as absent as Robert. Like, Viserys was in small council meetings. He just delegated a lot and partied.
Well, I think also Otto stepped up a lot more. I feel like she's got Adam... Alan. Mm. Oh god, I'm never gonna get them the right way around.
Alan, yeah.
She's got Alan who's, you know, starting to, you know, apply her will and give her good information, but he's not doing what Otto used to do for Viserys, which was literally Wallace would be like, "We've got pirates in the gullet, you've got to sort with it," and Otto would be like, "The king has heard, this is done." Mm. And take some of the mental load off of Rhaenyra. I feel like she doesn't have someone to take things off of her plate. They're still all coming back to her in the same way last episode episode 3 where it had like the matron of the chamber talking to her about bedding chain of command. And I feel like obviously that's improved. She's got more council members. There doesn't seem to be like a hierarchy, a chain of command. There doesn't seem to be necessarily, at least at this point, a real flow of communication or like people taking the initiative regarding their position.
Yeah,
still seems to all be coming back to her. And so, of course, she's going to get burnout because of the sheer amount of mental load. So it's interesting to see where she's bringing people into the council that seem to be educated, qualified, and good at what they do. Like, there's no denying that Missaria is good at what she does. There's no denying that Daemon is good at what he does. There's no denying that Alan is doing a really good job. He's making good decisions, but there's still just not quite that natural flow that needs to happen to actually take some of the weight off of her shoulders. We'll see how it goes.
To be honest, they do good council scenes in you know, House of Dragon as well. Like, it does give a good, it's a good like exposition setting, isn't it, really? One thing I have noticed as well, which felt very smooth, was Sure, Torrin Manderley was giving the lowdown to Sabatha about the comings and goings on the council. If that had been a beginning of a series, that would have felt a bit like an exposition potato. But as a sort of a recap situation, I think it worked incredibly well.
I think it also puts you very much in the situation. I feel like I said at the beginning of this podcast that this episode didn't feel like much progressed, but a lot of things are kind of clicking away in the background. Like, I do like how much it's kind of not being seen that's kind of clicking away in the background. Like, Tumbleton wasn't seen at all this episode. We still know that Tumbleton is being held hostage. We still know that people are suffering in Tumbleton. We still know that, like the idea that she's hired more council people, that she's, you know, trying to resolve her, like, the finances that they got from the Eyrie have already run dry. Like, those little things that are just tick, tick, ticking away in the background, you do kind of need that, like, and this is where we're at the beginning of this episode. Like, things are happening, which again is why the timeline feels like it is, you know, 2 or 3 weeks at least have passed, I feel, between last episode and this episode. It's good. I like it.
Yeah, the time throws me, like, it did in Game of Thrones, to be honest, because I'm convinced there's a way to make it make sense, but I don't know.
We need to be in the writer's room. I think the writer's room have a very clear idea of exactly how many weeks, months, days have passed, but they're not sharing it.
I mean, that's assuming that these scenes happen in sequential order or whatever. Like, they wouldn't, because we go back and forth so much. It's, you know, just the storytelling mechanism. So I guess we realistically have to just take it as a more fluid concept and not think about it too much, because the storytelling will get in the way.
I do love the irony of us saying we shouldn't think about it too much. Well, how long have we been streaming today already? And I already have a lot of notes.
We have been streaming for 75 minutes. So, I know one note you must possibly have, which is
must possibly.
Well, I've already swung and missed already, but let's try again. Laris's speech to Aegon.
That was great.
I made some notes on that. The fact that you go.
Oh, I was just going to say it might. It's a speech up there with Game of Thrones, you know, like it completely, it's one of those things where it goes one way and then completely spins around in another. And it was kind of the chemistry between these two actors is just excellent. Like, the back and forth and all of that kind of stuff. It just chef's kiss, and this is where this is it at its best, really, where he is feeling sorry for himself, but then Laris, in his like very typical way, in one breath sort of tells him what he needs to know, which he couldn't realistically ever do at any other time. Like, this is his moment, but then just like, I mean, he cuts him down so fiercely. It's like, you've had all the same opportunities that Aemond has had. You've had the tutors. You've had the opportunities. You've had the dragon. And, what else could you have been given that...
I really loved the part where he was like, you've been so whiny with a determination that I find, like... amazing or whatever. I can't remember the exact line.
I've got it here. It's,
have you got it in front of you? Because it's such a good line. It's the, like, I'm impressed by how up your own arse you are, you whiny little bitch. Like, it's amazing how much you can be up your own bottom, get over it, you've had privileges. And I do my note on it specifically is that this is stuff that Viserys should have said to Aegon. Yes. This is Laris acting as the father figure that Aegon needed, the one who's telling him the truth. Like, we don't see him interacting, like, between Viserys and Aegon. I don't think we have a single scene between the two of them at all. There's group scenes.
I
don't think of a single scene between Aegon and Viserys. we have Aegon and Alicent, and during that time she's saying, "You're not my son," and then she's, you know, telling him at that point not a deliberate lie, but it turns out to be a mistruth.
Is Aegon, is that a Sunfire's scale or something?
Scale. I think it's a scale. I think he took a scale. Yeah. Maybe that might go towards potentially dragon raising magic, the fact that he's got a scale with him. Maybe. The idea that Larys is acting as a father figure to Aegon, while Alicent is acting as a mother figure to Aemond, and both of them are from Harrenhal.
Oh, yeah.
Alicent and Larys are very paired characters. They both potentially have green magic. They both are dark featured. They both are slightly mysterious and slightly creepy. And she is acting like the mother that Aegon always needed and wanted, one who's telling him to kind of, you know, that you could be loved, and you're not, you know, that. You can be the main character type thing. Like, he feels like he was never loved. I love the, like, one of the things that this series has done more than Game of Thrones ever did is paralleling scenes, where you have one scene with one character followed by another scene with another character, which are bookends to each other. And you have the whole sequence with Alice and Aemond, and him talking about how Aegon was the favorite and mother always forgot me and neglected me. And it, like, she never treated me fairly. He was always the golden boy. And you have Aegon saying exactly the same thing with Larys, saying mother always looked after little baby Aemond and, you know, looked after him in his stupid eye. You have those paired scenes with these two parallel brothers and these two paralleled Harrenhal-affiliated, potentially magical manipulators acting as the parents that they needed. It's just really good, kind of almost poetical storytelling when they do these. Like, so much of the series has that, and I don't remember it being a predominant feature of Game of Thrones, having shorter scenes, particularly shorter dialogue-based scenes, that are paired with an adjacent scene, either before or after a, like, interstitial scene. Like, having kind of, it, like, every episode rhymes, and I really love that.
Okay, so here's the line. Ever since you... was it dove into a battle you were not invited to, and since you were injured, you've done nothing but whinge and self-flagellate with a tenacity I find astonishing.
A tenacity I find astonishing.
That is...
I want that on a t-shirt if I wore graphic t-shirts.
Was it flown into a battle you weren't invited... flown in drunk to a battle you weren't invited to or something? This is going to be interesting to play out when Aegon makes his you know, return to the throne, because it's going to be like, how is this going to impact him? We know what he does to Rhaenyra, because Game of Thrones has told us that, but I don't know much about his return, because am I right in thinking that he dies soon after or something?
Yeah.
I don't want to be too spoiled.
You know, this whole generation of Targaryens, you know, is not long for this world.
Yeah.
I think
a lot of them. I'm interested in seeing the dragon scene where they storm the dragon pit, where the commoners storm the dragon pit.
They did it. Was it this episode where they... talked a little bit about that, how they need to put more guards outside the dragon pit or something, or was it last episode? I remember.
How did they?
I remember that being a line.
I missed that, like, too.
Yeah.
Very briefly. It was like a blink and you miss it line.
Yeah. Was that in the council scene? Because there was so much interlocking.
Might have been. Yeah, that might have been where it was.
Yeah. I feel like the sort of thing that would have been. That's. If you don't know that that's coming, that's a great bit of foreshadowing as a throwaway line. That's kind of like Sansa going, "Oh, but Joffrey's nothing like that beast of a king." like that a little throwaway line where you're like, oh, maybe we should just put some extra guards outside of the dragon pit and just let it go. And then you can look back and go, oh shit, they did say it. Oh yeah. No.
Chekhov's unguarded doorway.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find the exact line.
I'm just thinking, I just came across another scene. Aegon stabs the guy that he's the bot.
Yes.
The pirate
guy. That's it, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I did enjoy the fact that during that scene, Tyland and Larys, who are like, obviously Tyland's maybe not very sneaky, but Larys is quite sneaky, having pretty open conversation about, you know, the king and fleeing and all that jazz. But again, the smile from Aegon at the end of that, Aegon at the end of that sequence is just a little unnerving. And I think it follows on from the sequence when they escaped from the cart and they had that sort of almost slapsticky fight.
Yeah, bonk.
When they escaped from the Riverman, which has the idea that when push comes to shove, like, even though we're getting some good character progression from Aegon, Aegon is sadistic. He does like watching and causing harm to others. Like, we understand how he potentially got to this point, but he can and does enjoy committing violence.
I know what you mean. Like, I don't know if enjoys
watching
the...
his potential bastards pit fight. Like,
yeah,
he likes the children fighting rings. Like, he's not a nice dude.
He's not. No, I mean, can he change? Is this changing him? It might not. Like, he didn't change Jaime or the hardship that he went through in Game of Thrones.
I feel like it's potentially making his feelings on it more complex. But, like, this is now the second time on this journey with Larys where he's had to, quote-unquote, get his hands dirty.
Yeah.
And I feel like this one in particular, last one was kind of in the heat of the moment. It kind of reminded me of the Tyrion fight sequence when he was on the way to the Vale with Kat. Is much more targeted as a, like, how many times did he stab that guy? And, like, watch him bleed out through his mouth onto his hands, and then he smiled at the end of that sequence. Like, it's a slow smile. Like, I feel like his character is evolving. I feel like he's learning a lot. Mm. But I think his core self still has an innate joy for violence and vengeance. And again, I'll be interested to see how that parallels Rhaenyra as she goes forward, because what's continuously happening, particularly with Daemon, is her going, no, I don't want violence. No, I don't want violence. I want to, you know, keep it good. And Daemon constantly going, you're not this person. You need to be a dragon queen. You need to, like, become this other kind of more aggressive version of yourself. Mm. So it's interesting that there is some potential Targaryen inbuilt passion for violence potentially. I don't know, it's like that smile at the end. And also, he did have a line earlier where it was interesting as well, when he was having his first conversation with Larys and they were fighting in the woods, and he said, I swear to the warrior will kill my brother, blah 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 blah. And so he's using the language of the Seven, because that's what he was brought up on. That's what Alicent brought him up on, the language of the Seven. He swears to the warrior in the same way that, you know, most Western people would say, I swear to God. Mm. Like, you know, oh my God, when you get something good. Like, I was watching a Chinese drama the other day, and someone rescued someone else and said, I'm so glad you're okay. And I was like, in a Western show, that would be, thank God you're all right.
Yeah.
And it was just this weird mental switch where I was like, oh, that is something that's integrated into Western culture, regardless of whether or not you're atheist or not. I still think, oh my God, as a general exclamation, like, of happiness or sadness or whatever. So the idea that he invoked the warrior by instinct, even if he's naturally Targaryen, could go into him being a more Faith of the Seven king in the future, but also him invoking the warrior and then murdering a guy at the end, at the point where, obviously, during that was just before Kristen's whole spiel to his knights about applying to the Seven and may the mother protect us and may the blah 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 blah. So I found it like a interesting parallel between him and Kristen, who Kristen obviously helped raise him and taught him how to sword fight, and Kristen bringing up the Seven and the Warrior during his speech, while also Christian was the one who taught him how to use swordplay and how to use underhanded techniques. If we're talking way back to the sequence in the yard with the Strong Boys back in the day, obviously in Targaryens, but the whole sequence where Simon Strong, Lionel Strong, whichever one the father was.
Harwin Strong.
It had Harwin teaching the guys to be kind of good fighters, and Christian by retaliation teaching the Hightower boys to be underhanded. It's interesting that when push comes to shove, Aegon is there shiving someone in the throat and demanding to be called king. He's demanding to be called king, and we know what people need to tell people that they're the king.
Yeah.
They are no true king. We know this. I found that whole kind of theme throughout the episode fun.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Have you got notes? Oh, sorry, Max.
I still have notes.
I was going to say, I found the line about... So it's from Daemon in the small council meeting at 12:10. He says, "There was a skirmish last night at the Dragon Gate. Horses were required to dispel it."
Okay. Yeah.
Bingo.
The Dragon Gate was just another entrance to King's Landing, but you're right. It probably is the entrance to the Dragon Pit. Again, good subtle foreshadowing. Nom 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 nom.
Yes.
Like a cheese board. I'm just eating a cracker.
Yeah.
Okay. So, let's see. Alice and Aegon. That whole set of scenes. Mm-hmm. I like the idea. Well, so the first sequence with Alice scaring off the attackers at nighttime inside Harrenhal. That I don't know how accurate that is, but this reminded me of, have either of you guys read Fall of the House of Usher?
No.
It's a Poe short story, horror story, and it terrified the holy heck out of me as a kid. Genuinely, I had nightmares. I remember getting full bed paralysis. Like I couldn't, I had to turn off. I couldn't move until I'd managed to reach for my nightlight with my left arm and turn my nightlight on, and then I couldn't leave my bedroom to go to the toilet in the night because I was so scared of leaving my bedroom. The story is a double layered story. So the primary story is the main character visiting an old friend, and the old friend, his sister's just died, and so he tells the story of how his sister into a coma and has been put into the crypt, and they have this long story and they reminisce about the sister, and then the friend goes off to bed and the hero sits and reads a scary story about a dragon, and the dragon's like crawling towards them, and there's a roar of the dragon and a screech of this monster, and while he's reading the book in reality, in while he sat in the sitting room, he's hearing creaking of noises and the scratching that coincides with the story he's telling. The actual story that's happening, the actual noises are coming from what's actually happening, is that the sister wasn't dead. She was, she slipped into a comatose state, and then she comes into the room. She's crawled out of the crypt, and she's like broke all her nails, and she's in this kind of trance-like state. And she enters at the end of the scene. She enters the room where he's reading his book, and the brother dies of shock upon seeing her, and then they both die, and then the house falls into a swamp. The tension that's built is this double-layered story where you have the story is being told about the story is being read by the character about this monster, and then the noises that are happening in the background, which coincide with the story but are actually something even more horrifying happening. And I felt like Alice's story about there being Harrenhal ghosts, I thought what was going to happen is the roaring and the creaking and the whistling was going to be Vhagar crawling around in Harrenhal. So like a reverse of the fall of House of Usher. So instead of it being a story about a dragon and then it turns out it's a ghost type creature, it was going to be a story about a ghost and then it turns out that it's a monster, a dragon. Now obviously that didn't happen because Vhagar is elsewhere potentially. We don't really know. But I just really liked that kind of creepy way of telling a story. And the fact that it was double layered. And the fact that she seemingly has power of storytelling at nighttime in the tower, but then later on when she basically tries the same thing in daylight, it is less effective. But I did enjoy the fact that I didn't enjoy the fact that it's what, the fourth attempted rape of this season. Like, can we not just
can we stop using it as a crutch for writing?
But the way I don't mind it as much, because one of the things that Aemond was saying to her about his esteem issues is that he feels like he's second to his brother, that he's you know, a lesser brother, he's, you know, weak and nothing without Vhagar. And so it almost feels like Alicent has set him up for a fairy tale heroic moment. He's rescuing the damsel from an attacker. She's been shown to successfully talk people down, and this time she starts the conversation, it just doesn't work. So it could be that she's less powerful during the daytime, or it just didn't work, or these guys just aren't appealing. Or it could be that she's specifically set it up so that he could have this hero's moment of rescuing the damsel, proving his value, proving his warrior status, getting his confidence back. And she's playing both the three different aspects of the kind of pagan womanhood. She's playing the maiden, mother, and crone. She's playing the damsel, she's playing the mother, and she's also playing this powerful sorceress all at once. And I enjoyed the fact that it kind of, it fulfills all the things that Aemond needs to feel to kind of get his confidence back. He needs to feel like he can stand, for the first time in his life, he needs to feel like he can stand on his two feet without Vhagar. It's one of those interesting things that he's got the skills. Like, he's, you know, he's theoretically a very good fighter, and he got shivved in the back by a gormless, strong person, or a tully person, whoever it was.
And that's a strong
it was,
boy. Yeah.
Yeah. He got shivved in the back by a kid. And he's never actually, outside of Vhagar, he's always found his self-esteem through Vhagar. He's never actually been able to go, I'm a competent fighter, I'm a valued son in my own right. He's always used Vhagar as a crutch. So I feel like he's speedrunning the mental health psychotherapy of Harrenhal, in that he's been injured, but he's now had his hero's moment. He's rescued the damsel, he's found value in his own self. I like the idea that she ended the scene by saying, you seem to be better, and it's not just the physical side of better, it's the, this again, genuinely, I think for this character, the first time he's ever actually, without Vhagar, really felt like he's in a power position.
But he was a good, he was a known good swordsman growing up.
He was a known good swordsman. I don't think he's ever psychologically digested that. I think he's always viewed himself as only relevant and only powerful because of the dragon, because that's how he was treated as a child. He was treated as nothing until he got the dragon. And I don't think he's ever really truly come to terms with the fact that he is a competent and valued fighter without Vhagar. And so, yeah, I found that interesting. I also enjoyed the makeup on his back during the sequence where he was kind of going up through Harrenhal, that shows that there seems to be some inflammation or infection, which plays into Helena's story about him burning but not burning.
Oh, okay. Was that from Sunfire, do you think?
No, as in Aemond?
Yeah. In the battle? In the battle? Was that through, is that Dragonfire or...?
No, so when he got chipped in the back, I think he's got an infection from that.
Ah, right, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, he's got, like, it looks like, so there's kind of vein track marks up his back, up his lower back. So that, to me, and he's had, obviously, like, fever dreams as well, because that's what...
Do you have, hang on a minute. Do you have a timestamp? Okay, I think I see it. Okay. So what are we?
When you see infection track marks, it kind of looks like that. When you have like an injury and then like veins kind of swell around it, and you can get that sort of almost like marbleizing track marks.
Okay, yeah.
And it kind of looks like that to me. So that makes sense if he's had some level of infection, and the idea of he's kind of burning from the inside out, if he's had a fever with potentially like partial sepsis while he's recovering from his being stabbed in the back. And that makes sense for Helena. He's burning but not burning, and he's having dreams of dragon fire. He's having Alicent says, you're just dreaming, it's just the old dream. It makes sense to me that that's happening.
I think that's the frame you're talking about, right, where he's got the
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it doesn't look like a huge wound. Like, it looks like probably a relatively deep wound, but not a huge wound. But that does look like infection track marks to me, from what I know of what they look like.
Yeah.
I'm not a doctor. I might bark up the wrong tree. But, like, it makes sense that he's had a feverish dream situation, and that, again, speedrunning the Harrenhal psychotherapy. He's having the dreams. He's having all
he's
of that.
He's also sleeping in the same bed as Stephen was.
And the other thing that I noticed with that as well is obviously one of the parallels that we haven't really looked at. The only time you really kind of think about the parallel is talking about Bloodraven, but the idea that Targaryens are these pale blonde, very fair skin generally, people with purple eyes seems to the connection's never really drawn with werewoods, the fact that werewoods have white faces and red eyes, and just the image of him with that mark up his back, with his white hair and everything, just reminded me of a werewood tree. And it kind of, again, feeds into the kind of mythology of Harrenhal, that there's this kind of old magic happening. He's sleeping in a werewood bed, and he's got this sort of branch-like, tree-like track marks up his back in red. That just kind of drew. And then that also parallels to at the end of the fight where he, quote-unquote, saves Alice. The last guy he kills, he shoves into a werewood root, doesn't he? Guy is, like, skewered on a werewood root.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so that's a blood sacrifice. So if we're talking about the blood of the old gods, they love their blood sacrifices. They love their all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm going to slow-mo that again just to see.
We'll keep that fight scene with Winslow. There seems to be a slight either cut moment or a continuity error where Alice seems to be, so Alice is pinned down, she gets rescued once, and there's another guy who tries to grab her, she like knocks him out, and then he goes and attacks Aegon. And then there's another guy that you see her like being like restrained by him, and then he's just not there in the next shot. And she's like, you know, kind of heavily breathing on the floor, and you know, she's like, okay, you seem better. I feel like I can't see the death of one of the attackers. I feel like there's like one death continuity missing in that little sequence. It's a good sequence, and like Aegon looks cool. He's a good fighter. Good for him. But I feel like there's like a shot missing.
I think I know what you mean, but I think the guy you're looking for.
I mean, in all fairness, I am very tired when I watch the sequence.
It's hard to keep track of. I'm watching it now.
It's slightly chaotic.
It's very chaotic. But I think he does come across. It's just not. I could be wrong. Totally wrong, because it's such a chaotic thing. I think he moves quickly and a bit. Yeah, he comes away from Alice and hits Aemon relatively quickly. And it's. I don't even think it's entirely in frame.
Yeah. So, you know, it's fine, but I did like the idea that potentially a blood sacrifice upon the werewood tree is potentially what's going to, you know, get Aemon back on his feet. And that would just make sense in the mythology of the old gods.
Yeah.
I have a couple of really quick, tiny ones on my notes, and then I've got a slightly more elongated one that I want to go through. But I felt sorry for the poor horses that died.
Times.
I was miserable. I didn't like the up-close visuals of that. The idea of the lore of Flea Bottom, and that the coulda, woulda, shoulda, which someone in the live video, who was it? X-Rex was saying if they'd made Damon had been made heir, then all of this would have been fine. And everyone would have followed Damon as the true king instead of Rhaenyra. The coulda, woulda, shouldas of the first season and the second season, if they'd stayed in King's Landing and, you know, established and kept track of the gold and not abandoned Viserys to have Alicent become regent and let Otto take over, coulda woulda shoulda. But if Daemon had stayed as in charge of the gold cloaks, then the law of Flea Bottom wouldn't have become so out of hand. But you know, we can't go back. Coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Well, yeah, but also,
they left because she was scared for her bastard children.
The natural line of succession would have changed with Aegon anyway, right? Whether or not Daemon was named heir, right?
Yes.
It'd be up in the air, like it was with Rhaenyra, but I think they'd be more likely to, you know, take Daemon over Rhaenyra.
It would have been if Viserys held out on not naming an heir and then had married Alicent and then had Aegon, then Aegon would have been the unrecruited heir.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these different options. If Daemon would have been named heir as default, they wouldn't have put Rhaenyra into the listing, and then Aegon came along, then Daemon might have just killed Aegon as a baby, or he might have been like, yeah, that's fine, that's my brother's heir. Like, there's so many what-ifs in this sort of a story. It's a tangled web. But the idea of, if, like, there's so many different, like, turning doors within the story where if they'd just done one thing different, maybe everything would have been different. Just the mention of the fact that the gold cloaks have been kind of not neglected, but not fortified is one of the coulda, woulda, shouldas. The conversation with Daeron, where they bring up the Woman of Dawn and say that she was ugly and a hag, but she was smart, and you can't have it both ways because women are only one thing or the other.
What's the term and thick of waste or something, was that?
Thick of waste, yeah, which I feel like is a kind of a slight nod and a wink to the Third Wall, because isn't that what Rhaenyra is described as in the later part of Blood and Fire? Is it Rhaenyra described as being thick of waste?
Yeah, they, you know, it says that she, you know,
she, like, got fat after she had kids. Fat. She's stressy. Yeah.
And while her people are starving. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like that could be a nod across the Third Wall, or it could just be him being a misogynist, which is no news. Yeah. And I also like the fact that he referred to as the Targaryens and their dragons to Daeron, as in, you know, you are the other and your dragons are the other. And the, again, making, trying to kind of manipulate him into thinking that his dragon ownership is the evil and the wrong of the world. So it's just more manipulation.
I mean, he's not wrong on that particular account, right? Like, things settled down a lot more once the dragons had gone. So
there's less nukes in the world.
Yeah, but also
still death, but there's less nukes.
Okay, so here's a what if. Would Ormond, right? Let's say that Ormond manages to get Daeron on the throne. Daeron's dragon is one of the youngest. Does Ormond kill Daeron's dragon?
I wouldn't be shocked if he did. The vibe I got, and this is a very specific Game of Thrones vibe, but I'll be interested if either of you guys had this kind of feeling. Cersei's opinion on Lady, killing of Lady, and having Lady chained, kind of reminded me of the scene in the last episode where Daeron's dragon is chained in the Sept. Uh-huh. And Ormond's relationship with the dragon in that sequence. I don't know whether or not that was just me, but it just kind of gave me that impression that, like, if he could, like, it feels like the dragon, I can't remember what Daeron's dragon is called, but if Daeron's dragon could kill Ormond to defend Daeron, he would. Like, there's a level of, like, kind of defensive guard dog happening between those two. And I think they would both be happy to kill the other to get Daeron round to their side.
Yeah.
I can see that being a thing. What other quickfire ones do I have? Rhaenyra's whole thing about not being able to see her child, seeing Joffrey, and her avoiding him. You know, she can either be queen or she can be a mother. She can't really be both. Mm-hmm. And the idea that the only person we see sleeping this episode is Joffrey. Joffrey is innocent. He can rest while Baela, Rhaenyra, Alicent, Aemond, they're all like uneasy sleeping or unable to sleep or unwell rested. I really like the makeup on Baela. Baela looked really genuinely so tired in the scene with Alan. Adam, one day I'll get it right. I enjoyed like the fact that this whole political party, this whole side is just exhausted. And then at the end, obviously Cole talking about, and the stranger offers us rest, the idea that the only rest is death. Like until that point they're just like living is exhaustion and rest is the death is the only rest.
To be fair, what else do you give the stranger? What else do you give death? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, well,
yeah, he offers us peace.
The father, the mother, the maiden, the smith, all of those, they've got positive traits instinctively about them, all of them, except the stranger, which obviously symbolizes death. It's like, what else can you say is good about death other than, yeah, it's like, it's the ultimate position of laziness, which is a weird way to describe it, right? Like, you know, are you really lazy? You know, like, well, I guess you can look forward to being dead because that's as lazy as you can possibly get.
But I just like how that fed into the idea of the fact that everyone's kind of exhausted. Hmm. Like, there is no rest for this party. There is no rest for Daemon. There is no rest for Alicent or Baela or anyone. The only person who's getting rest is the innocent and the dead. And I like that. And I like the idea that Rhaenyra is kind of afraid of Joffrey or afraid of being around Joffrey, and potentially I think there's guilt there and all of that sort of thing.
Well, it's like she's I don't want to say she's gotten two of her sons killed, but because that they were both out of her hands.
I think she takes ownership for it though. I don't think any, again, as not a parent, I don't think any parent can experience the death of a child without taking some of the onus onto themselves, unless they are actively psychotic. And you know, she particularly, I think with Luke, I think she probably takes more of the blame for it because she was the one who sent him to Storm's End. I think she takes potentially less of the blame for Jace because Jace specifically went off against her wishes and against her demands. But I think this is still that relevant thing. The interesting thing with Joffrey coming back, though, is she hasn't questioned where Rhaenyra is. Nope. Rhaenyra, who was meant to be looking after Joffrey. Rhaenyra, who's that? Like, she doesn't go, oh, and where are the children of Rhaenyra?
Would she be with Viserys and Aegon the Younger?
Presumably. But I don't know. I found it interesting that there's been no mention of Rhaenyra this episode.
Yeah, because are her two boys she had with Daemon, are they supposed to be in Pentos right now or something?
They were on their way to Pentos when we last saw them. They were meant to go with Rhaenyra. And at some point we need a scene with whoever they're sending them to in Pentos going, isn't it meant to be a princess with you guys?
Is she just under the assumption that that Rhaenyra is she's fine, just in Pentos, probably going to parties or something, you know, living it up, probably got a hangover.
She has no real connection to Rhaenyra, but also poor Rhaenyra. And then all the rest of my notes are about the Helena Alicent plot lines.
Okay, let's. Any conspiracy theories or?
So it's mostly just character stuff. So in terms of conspiracy theories, what does the don't eat that, that's that would make poison to us, that Helena was talking to Jacera. She was talking about either bugs or Jahira, berries in the God's Wood of King's Landing, and saying don't eat that, that would be poison to us, after refusing to drink the poison tea. So again, mm-hmm. we pay attention to Helena. What she says is truth. I found from a character, Max, you go.
Yeah, and you know, they show the caterpillars. I think that is a not so thinly veiled reference. And they did mention butterflies earlier to George's post.
Oh, yeah.
I feel, again, I've heard that that's a wink across the fourth wall to the butterfly effect of changing things in the story that George views as gospel. I also found it interesting. Helena at one point says that she wants to see the moon. She needs to see the moon for some reason. And I don't
know. Yeah, that got me nervous.
That got me nervous. I really enjoyed. So one of the things that I was hoping for that has actually happened is one of the, I think I mentioned it last episode, is one of the things that, as far as I know from the books, is prior to the death of the children and the blood and cheese thing, Helena's supposedly quite normal, and then afterwards she becomes a bit crazy. But because of how her character's been presented, she's always been a little bit unusual. So I enjoy the fact that what seems to be the character change post the death of her son and the trauma of that is she seems to really be self-advocating in a way that she hasn't previously. Prior to the death of her son, that there's not been as much self-advocation. And now she's saying, no, the child is mine. No, I'm not drinking it. It's not tea. We know it's not tea. I want to leave. I need to leave. I want to see her actually putting her foot down about her wants and her needs. Versus Alicent, for all of these years, who's not said what her wants and her needs are, or even thought about what her wants and her needs are. And Helena actually saying what her wants and her needs are, and really self-advocating, feels like not an insignificant character development for her.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's also blatantly telling Alicent what she knows. And Alison still not quite getting it, but her saying to Alison, I know where he is. He's at Hagrin Hall. I've seen him.
Yeah.
I know this. Is really good. And like the fact that Alison's willing to swig moon tea when she's not pregnant. I can only imagine how bad that must be for your fertility if you're drinking it when you don't have a pregnancy.
I mean, she's holding she's holding like a damp cushion to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's so pale. The makeup in that sequence is miserable. Like the fact that she's calling it it delivered her. It was a gift from Old Town that saved her from shame and damnation. It's a gift. It's a gift. It's a gift. And then when she swigs it to save her daughter from revealing the secret, and then the next sequence, she looks like she's at death's door. And the fact that she's, after making that decision as well, she sells or uses her necklace, she gives up the Faith of the Seven. She gives up her protection as a Faith of the Seven to use as money to bribe a maid.
Mm.
Like that, if that's not allegory, I don't know what is. The fact that she's willing to give up the protection of her faith for the sake of being able to get her daughter out. Is great. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
And her whole conversation with Masari is great. I think the idea that Alicent knows Rhaemyra better than maybe Rhaemyra knows herself, and the idea that she's aware that Rhaemyra and Daemon have dragons inside of them. There, they've got their internal dragon fire, their internal Targaryen stuff going on, and the idea that she suspects that eventually Rhaemyra will side with Daemon. And where will that lead Missaria? It's interesting to see Alison really effectively play the game. I feel like when you
to that scene,
when you look back at the sequences in season 2 with her on the council, and she's effectively running the country, but she's not treated with enough respect for what she can do and what she's able to discern. Mm-hmm. And I feel like between her and in that conversation, she's able to read the room and play the sides really, really, really well. And she's willing to sacrifice. Like, I feel like, obviously, she was hoping that she could get away with hiding the moon tea and hiding Helena's pregnancy. But then the fact that Missaria both knows that she lied to protect her daughter and knows that she was willing to physically sacrifice to protect her daughter. Like, in an ideal world, you know, the lie would have passed, they would have escaped, all of that sort of thing. But in this non-ideal circumstance, what that has shown to the white worm, this mythological white worm, is that Alison is willing to sacrifice her physical body, her religion, and her safety to get her daughter safe. And that's not nothing. That's not something that moral coin in the bank for Missaria.
So you were theorizing in last week that Missaria, was it last week, the week before, or both, maybe, that Missaria might not be as trustworthy as...
I still don't necessarily trust her. So this is how I feel about Missaria, to clarify my thoughts from the previous week. I think she genuinely has a really strong, good moral core. I don't know whether or not that moral core specifically aligns with the Targaryen royalty, and that her position of authority that she's managed to make it to within the position within the Targaryen royalty could be a stepping stone towards something different. I don't think that her loyalty is to Rhaenyra. I think her loyalty is to something else. Now, that could be genuinely just to the small folk, or there could be another layer to it. So I think she has a good intentioned moral core. And I think that's why Alicent and her actions in this episode can really help solidify them as potential future allies. But I just don't think she's necessarily loyal to Rhaenyra, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I by and large agree with that. Like, I think your point about, you know, when push comes to shove, Rhaenyra's probably going to go with Daemon over Missaria is, or at least there's a risk of that happening.
There's a risk.
Then that puts Missaria in a precarious position because she hasn't got many friends.
No, she has not. And she's now, you know, she's sold the last bit of jewelry that she has. Like, she's been dressed down a lot of this season so far because she's been captive. She's been wandering around in her pajamas. And I do love the maid outfits. Like, I really love the kind of the uniform of the household, and the fact that it's been a while since I've done a Jenny's favorite costume shout out, but I will say the maid outfits are probably one of my favorite costume shout outs because it's practical, hard wearing, solid wool that's clean, it's well cut, it's well finished, there's no like staining or like you can tell that it's a royal household uniform. It looks comfortable, it looks movable, it looks supportive. It's in keeping with some of the styles that we've seen. It's got a similar structure to a lot of other garments, but it looks like it's weather variable. It's got like linen or cotton underlayers, so it will be okay for sweating if you're working hard, but also warm enough. Wool is hard wearing. It's a dark color, which means that it will take on stains from cleaning really well. I think it's very flattering on both the actors, which is, you know, you want the actors to look good. The hair covering is very in keeping with medieval history and also will again help hide if they were trying, if they were successful in sneaking out.
Well, I mean,
hiding.
Yeah, Targaryen if they were hair, successful,
Targaryen hair, you need to cover it up. So from a story standpoint, having that sort of hood is a very good design. I really liked that, and I really like the fact that it looks very clean, but of course you would spend time laundering for royal household maids to look clean and presentable, but also hide dirt well. Jenny, shout out for costumes on this episode. Other than I still love Alice's dress. I think Alice looks like a medieval witch princess, and I love it so much. But like the shout out for like good costume work this episode, I want to give to the matching maids' outfits. The last thing on that sequence, which is my last note, is all while knowing to hide the potion, the moon tea. He puts the moon tea in his pocket, but he has another potion to present to the guards, which is more than the Grand Maester did when he was going to Rhaemyra in season one. In season one, he obviously goes and presents her with moon tea and then basically leaves out for anyone to see, which kind of falls into the maybe anti-Targaryen things, like shaming the heir to the throne, revealing that, him visiting in the middle of the night. Obviously, Viserys commanded him to do it, but could have done it with a little bit more subtlety. Mm-hmm. While actually knowing how to do subtle properly, and then Alison hiding the tea in a cupboard. And so even though it gives a point to Missaria for not only working out that Allwhile was being surreptitious, then also immediately also knowing what it's about, and Alison having to be forced into a false confession and then having to be forced into drinking it herself is great. And the fact that they immediately know just from smelling it what it is. Because, of course, you worked in a whorehouse, you would know what moon tea smelled like.
It's like, this is just normal tea, watch!
And then the final part of it is the fact that Helena is not only self-advocating for herself, saying, no, this is my baby, but she's also saying, no, I can't. I can't drink that tea. And Alison's saying, yes, you can. I think Helena's saying, no, I can't, because she's, again, she's kind of living in this multi-timeline existential space where she can't because she won't, because she hasn't, because she won't. Like, it's not like she's kind of living on a fixed timeline. She already knows that she won't. She already knows that she can't, because she's already seen that the baby is going to be where the baby is. She's already seen, like, I feel like that I can't isn't just self-advocation. It's also her saying, I can't because I've already seen that I don't.
Yeah.
Like, the timeline's already happened to her. She's already seen that she doesn't take moon tea, that she has the baby, theoretically. Yeah. So there's no point, in the same way that you're saying to Aegon in the last season, there's no point, you kill me, but there's no point. She already knows what's happening next. She already knows that she can't take the potion because the future's already set in stone. The baby comes. And did you guys notice that Alicent and Helena are in the tapestry in the opening credits?
The tapestry?
And I don't think that in the opening credits, I don't think they were in last episode. It's like literally a one or two frame shot of Alicent next to Helena in the tapestry. And also, did you guys notice that Alice was embroidering this episode?
She was, wasn't that her, she?
The only other character we've seen embroidering is Helena. And so it goes into the idea that Alicent and Helena are kind of similar entities. They both have the similar sort of mystical energy. They both have a connection with Aemond. They both have, like, just those parallels coming through, like a dark and a light sister. And, like, the only other person we've seen embroidering on an embroidery hoop is Helena. And then we saw Alice doing it while waiting for Aemond to wake up.
It's how they communicate, isn't it? They embroider.
And then they send it via pigeons.
Yeah. I'm not finding this hidden frame.
I've closed the tab. Let me see if I can find it. I'll be interested to see whether or not this is, maybe we finally found out what the gap is between my streaming and your streaming.
I see Corlys and
it's quite near the end of the
Jace. I see Rhaenyra.
I think I see what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, wait,
it's quite near the end of the sequence.
Oh, wait a minute.
132.
Yeah, just before the crowd.
I've got 14 seconds more of adverts, and then I'll see whether or not I get you a timestamp, but you'll probably find it before my adverts are up.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's literally just one shot, but it was just, given how much of this episode is Helena and Alicent almost communicating, like Helena actually really clearly communicating for the first time, as far as I remember, in seasons, versus Alicent really not being able to receive what she's saying.
Yeah.
I've got it at 132.
Okay.
Yeah, same.
What is the length of your episode, Jenny? Just to
1 hour 59 seconds.
Oh, well, mine is 1 hour 3 minutes and 24 seconds.
Yeah, we're the same again.
So you guys have got theoretically an extra 2 minutes. I'm so confused. I mean, I'm translating this brunette person and this whitehead person as Alison and Helena. It could be, again, it's not 100% clear. It could be Alice and Amund. However, the blonde haired one doesn't have a blue eye, so I'm assuming it is Alice and Helena.
Or it won't be, but it could be Laris and Aegon.
It could be. Although they've got long curly brown hair, so yeah. I at some point we've got to do like this matched watch along, work out what you guys get that I don't, because I'm so curious. So one sec, let me do a little hop skip. Mm-hmm. So my credits, I've got Nina Lopez Colorado directed by at 152. At the end of the credit, and then the end credit. Let me have a quick look at my end credit. Skip. All of the from the Kristen Cole finding the
right. I've got directed by Nina Lopez Corrado at 152.
I can't remember what I said now.
Yeah, you said 152.
Mimi says hi, by the way. 152. Yeah. Okay, so that matches up. End credit, just skipping through Damon, smashing the lamp.
Right, the moment where it just goes black.
Okay.
Oh, well, I've got it at 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 5 seconds.
I've got it at 59:45, where it goes black at the end. Yeah. 59:45. I'm just so fascinated by this, because I feel like if there was something like a line missing or a shot missing, enough people analyze the show for them to work out that there's some sort of I don't know whether you can hear me.
Yeah.
I don't, like, I feel like people would notice if there's like a fundamental difference.
2 minutes though, that's not nothing. That's a, like, scene.
It's not nothing. That's a scene, or it's multiple lines, or it's multiple shots. I feel like enough people watch this cross internationally to have worked it out if there was something happening. It's bizarre. She's shedding like crazy right now because it's hot still.
Oh, God, yeah. It's
just a wall of black and grey fluff.
How are the furballs?
She's a little bit arthritic, so she doesn't tend to... She's also a short hair, so that helps. But she's more that she's not very good at self-grooming now. Oh. Like a lot of her hips and booty area gets a bit neglected, and I've got to go on with a comb because she's an old girl. Like, I got her at 15, and it's been 2 years come December, so she's at least 16 coming up to 17. And you know, she's not a spring chicken.
Yeah.
She's been very affectionate the last day or two. She was snuggled in bed with me earlier. And she's pottering around the love seat, probably just wanting dinner.
Oh,
she's getting scritches, so she's quiet at the moment. She's like, I have attention, good.
Attention, yeah. Attention only goes so far, doesn't it? And then it's...
And then it's, can I have snack?
Snack.
Which I empathise with. I'm oftentimes that same personality, so we're well matched.
Well.
But yeah, that is the end of my notes. I just, the Alice-Helena combo, and the all of the stuff involving Alicent. And we talked about previously that Alice kind of, she's giving off mother, sister, wife vibes to Aemond, and again, he's speedrunning his mental health stuff. He's going to come out of this. Again, we talked a little bit about when he took Harrenhal, how he looked just a little bit like Daemon, but a bit kind of goofy, a bit less self-assured. Mm-hmm. I'll be interested to see whether or not, now that he's sped run the Harrenhal psychotherapy, he might come out of it genuinely confident rather than using Vhagar as a crutch.
Since we know his death's assured, what possible character development is he really going to resolve, though?
Well, I think he's been, you know, saying on and off for a while, I would like to challenge my uncle in battle, but given that we've also seen him, you know, snuggled up like a little baby with his madam and with Alicent, I think he's been putting on airs of confidence. I feel like this Harrenhal experience will actually mean that he's genuinely ready to go on to the next phase. And I think maybe he can, like, I feel like between the unresolved trauma of childhood from the bullying, so that he never felt that he was worthwhile until he got a dragon, combined with the fact that Vhagar disobeyed him and killed Luke. So the one thing that he held to himself as a source of power meant nothing in the moment. Like, he had to lie about him deliberately killing Luke, and it was just him losing control of his dragon. Then also being shivved in the back by a gormless kid. I feel like he's had a big couple of massive dips in confidence. And so actually coming out of Harrenhal with a genuine self-assuredness, I'm very tired. This could be weird brain connection, or this could be a really insightful statement. I don't want to actually commit to it too much. But in Frozen, Elsa's very famous song, Let It Go, is a false art. Her whole thing is like, I'm so confident now, I've let it all go, I don't have to be scared anymore of my powers or my fear or anything. And it's complete and utter false establishment of power, because she's not actually had self-reflection. She's not actually come to terms with her power. She's run away. She has run away and hid herself in isolation, and she's not actually taken the time or had the ability or the skills or the support to have that realization that she can control her powers and that she needs to accept her powers. I feel like Aemond's Vhagar situation is similar. So he's had his false feeling of power and his false feeling of I'm the baddest bitch around, look at my ice palace, look at my dragon. And then this is when it actually, so in Frozen 2, she actually has her kind of real feeling that she's actually connected with her powers and really feeling like she's okay in herself. She can be herself as well as having her powers. And I feel like this is a similar thing for Aemond, where he's gone from being, I'm a sassy ice princess, I've totally got this down, while actually not coming to terms with the psychological side of things that led to that circumstance. And this season is the one where he can actually go forth a more fulfilled person. And that makes him scarier and dangerous, more dangerous in many ways. But yes, a bizarre metaphor to bring those two characters together. But that's how I see it. I feel like his Vhagar situation was a false power dynamic, a false feeling of security. Because unless you have the assuredness internally to hold the weight of your power, then you're not going to be able to hold the power. And I feel like that's a lesson that Rhaenyra hasn't technically learned. I feel like Rhaenyra needs to go to Harrenhal and get it on with Alice and do her Harrenhal psychotherapy. And then she'll be a good queen. Come to terms with the trauma of her father's lack of communication skills. But of all the ways to end the Oz Theory podcast for this week, a comparison to Frozen 1 and 2 was probably not what you were after.
Well,
they're both about white-haired bitches.
We've got an 11th hour suggestion from Max. I don't know if you've just checked the Discord there.
Oh, did we?
We might have.
It's a theory.
It's a theory.
Untapped. My evidence is Google AI, but I'm pulling from real info.
Yeah, Reddit and YouTube.
Yeah.
So
it's a frames thing?
I think it is. I think, you know, to fit it in, because it's recorded at 24 frames a second, but it's broadcast on cable in the UK, on Sky Atlantic, I guess, at 1 frame per second faster than it is in North America. So that, I mean, if our time codes are different by like 4%, about 4%, then
that's about 4%, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so. So I'm just watching it slightly faster.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's so weird. Okay, well, it's nice to have a genuine reason. 4% different.
Yeah.
But, like, it doesn't feel faster. I will say the one.
Well, it's barely faster, noticeable at that rate.
Yeah. Yeah. The only place it feels kind of faster is some of the times when it would cut to adverts and it cuts to black and then transitions. Okay,
there are no ads on HBO.
Yeah, so there's a opening ad on Now TV, but there's no ads during the main show. But there is a multiple like blackout moments during the thing, as if it was being presented on television and would have adverts.
That would be that'd be the UK.
That's
television
funny because HBO doesn't do that.
No, but Sky does. Sky Atlantic.
Uh-huh.
Sky Atlantic does.
So that would probably edited for that.
Whenever it cuts to one of those black frames, it always feels like it's a really, really awkward cut.
Hmm.
Like it always feels like it's not quite transitioning properly. I suppose I'm used to a lot of
it's like it's like watching the BBC America cut of Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah,
because there's no ads. Yeah.
There's no ads on BBC
broadcast for you guys, but then when they were broadcast on BBC America here, they had to awkwardly shove ads in.
Yeah.
I think the thing is, I'm used to when I watch American TV shows, I'm used to like a lot of the American TV shows that I watch are my kind of dumb comfort watching shows. And so they will really play up to the ad breaks.
Yeah,
and so they'll really have like we're building into the ad break now, and then we'll have the ad break, and then we come back and we do a very brief recap of what happened in the last, you know, 10 minutes of programming before the advert break. And so I think part of the reason why it feels so jarring to have the ad breaks inserted is because Game of Thrones isn't designed for it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really feel like you're going, okay, now time for intermission. It just feels like that was a strange cut. Yeah, it's interesting, but yeah, the slightly higher frame rate is that. I mean, it's an answer. It makes sense.
I think that's it, really, because we have yet to come across anything that has been explicitly cut out up until the first credits is bang on the same. So it seems that it is a gradual and consistent. Movement apart from each other. So at the beginning we'd be most similar, and at the end we'd be most different. And I think that that kind of explains it for me.
Yeah, because that makes so much sense as well, because genuinely, if there was like a line or a scene, or like it takes a lot of money to shoot a beautiful landscape vista or animate a dragon, or you know, have an actor on screen, and to cut a shot unnecessarily, that's a lot of money in the bin. So, yeah, I think we found the solution. Yay! We've learned something new.
You're not missing anything, Jenny. So
I'm not missing anything.
Feel relieved about that. you're watching it faster than us, so you get the
information. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just absorbing information at a faster rate.
Well, there we go. So you can watch it more times for this.
I could do my full rewatch. And if it's 4% faster, how many episodes do we have now? We have like 40 episodes, we'll take like 36 episodes. How many episodes per season? 30 episodes per season. If I were to watch it at 4% faster, that's like I could get like maybe like 20 minutes. I could rewatch the entire series 20 minutes faster than you guys.
Yeah.
If I put them all together.
Mm-hmm. So there we go. Another case solved.
Yes, our House of the Dragon detective agency is successful.
There we go.
Oh, I'm excited about next week.
Yeah, no, it's all going to be. I mean, I really enjoy, even though this episode felt slower, I enjoyed it just as much as the rest of them, and I think a lot of other people did as well.
I do enjoy the show gives time for character scene, like, and I think we needed a character episode where we're really bouncing around from character to character, and it's good
dialogue, good character moments, loved it. Yeah. It's hard
to enjoy the show.
Yeah, it's hard to give, like, each show is a different piece of the puzzle. It's hard to say this episode is better than that episode because they serve different purposes. This episode serves a different purpose than a battle episode, for example. But you need one to get to the other, so.
Yeah, and there's episodes that are, like, more, you know, enjoyable to watch.
Yeah.
And there's episodes that have, like, much more dramatic pathos.
Yeah.
And you can't have a roller coaster on just going ups. You've got to have the dips and rises and the flats so that you can have that build up and that drop.
Yeah.
And this show is definitely a very good ride. It's a fun time.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Incidentally, I'm not going to check my schedule now, but I've got, but I might be able to do next week's episode a bit sooner, like on a Tuesday. I'll just double check if you're.
Let me grab my phone because I took my manager actually sent the roaches out ahead of time. I am shocked.
Sorry, what was that, Max, that you said?
I think Monday or Tuesday should work for me.
Jenny's got the old D&D on Wednesday.
Let's see. This would be week commencing the 27th.
Yeah.
So Monday and Tuesday, I can do. Sorry, late-ish on Tuesday.
I've got a super early on Wednesday, actually.
Sorry.
No worries.
So Monday, I could probably do late-ish on Monday.
Okay.
Monday I should. Option. Let me. Did I take a picture of the? Let me just check what the work diary is for Monday. Because let's see how busy work is. Time I can finish.
Shall we just wrap up the podcast as we work out time?
Sorry, turning into an organizational session.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that was, I started it. Don't worry. It's like, anyway, thank you everyone for watching, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.